The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. This week, we've got another topic that was prompted by a listener email. I think I warned you about it last week on the EDU show. It's a question, or I guess a topic of RMDs. We've been talking recently a fair amount about RMDs and distribution rules for inherited accounts, but we haven't talked for a while about the basics of RMDs as it applies to the original account holder. The original person who set up the retirement accounts themselves that are subject to RMDs, how are those handled? What are the nuances of some of them? That sort of thing. So think of this as kind of maybe a refresher on RMDs or maybe an introduction to those RMDs if you haven't learned about those in the past. So I personally haven't read the full email itself. Those emails, as usual, go into Jim. If you want to send in an email as a suggestion for an EDU show, he's the one to send it to. I'll go ahead and give you his email address right now, right off the top. Jim at jimhelps.com would be the email. Make sure in the subject line itself that you indicate that it's a suggestion for the podcast, and we'll put it into the consideration pile itself. So, Jim, thanks for joining me, and look forward to hearing what this email is about and having a chance to talk to people about RMDs.
Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but the email is quite short and rather boring. It just got me to thinking that I can take the topic. It has to do with RMDs with a difficult to value asset. And I thought, well, we could do that as a Q&A, but we haven't chatted about RMDs in a long time. And now before y'all start throwing tomatoes at the podcast you got there, We talked a lot about RMDs from inherited IRAs lately, but we haven't, Chris, reviewed required minimum distributions for people when they're alive. That's actually the easiest way to calculate RMDs and understand the rules. When you're alive, it's fairly straightforward. It's a couple of nuances here and there, but it's fairly straightforward. But we haven't gone over it in a while. Typical for an EDU show, folks, I'm going to take a very simple topic and I'm going to delve deep into it and hopefully teach you a lot that you might not have known or taken into account with required minimum distributions, because it does seem like a fairly straightforward, simple, and basic concept. And it is. Understanding RMDs when you are alive is a lot easier than your beneficiaries will have to deal with at your passing. Those rules are just archaic, and that's what we have been teaching you. Inherited IRA rules are a nightmare. But while you're alive, it's fairly straightforward. So the email, Chris, just got me to thinking about RMDs in general, and I thought, well, he's got a question about a small aspect of RMDs. Let's do a whole show where I'll teach everybody again about RMDs, hopefully teach you some things that you didn't know or had forgotten, and then also delve into a little bit with his question. How do you do RMDs on a difficult-to-value asset? And some of these difficult-to-value assets, especially the one that he talks about, adds a whole host of other issues with simple, basic RMDs. So that's what we're going to do today. That's why I said, hey, let's do a podcast on a topic that everyone takes for granted, but required minimum distributions. Anyways, fairly straightforward, is it not?
Well, as with most things regarding retirement accounts, the basics are pretty straightforward, but you can pretty quickly get into the weeds, and there's opportunity for people to make mistakes, and there's almost always some sort of punishment or penalties if you do, so it's something important to understand.
Okay, so at its face value, the I in IRA stands for individual. But the reality is they're joint accounts, every single one. Who's it a joint account with, Chris?
Well, with your favorite uncle, Uncle Sam.
Exactly. So even though the I in IRA stands for individual, the R stands for retirement, the A stands for what, Chris?
Arrangement.
Arrangement, which is bizarre, but that's what they call it. The industry kind of uses the word account, which is very easy to remember, individual retirement account, but the IRS calls them individual retirement arrangements. The I is individual, and Chris and I say that all the time, and you can never have a joint IRA. But the fact of the matter is your traditional IRA, Roth IRAs have no RMDs, at least while you're alive. At your death, there are. But again, we're not talking about death today. We're talking about you alive. So we're just going to talk about IRAs. These rules will generally transfer over to employer-sponsored plans with a couple of caveats that I'll try to remember to point out to you as we proceed. But the I is individual, but the fact of the matter is they are all joint accounts. And that uncle of yours, he's a little bit impatient, shall we say, and he wants his share, but he doesn't get his share unless you take money out of it.
Right.
So he passed a rule that said, hey, at a certain age, you got to take money out of your account. Everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people ask Chris and I, why does the government make me take money out of my IRA? And tell me the minimum amount I have to take out. Because for a lot of people listening to this podcast, you won't need your full RMD amount during your retirement in any given year. Now, that's not something that everybody gets to experience. The general public as a whole, they probably need their RMD and then some. But most people who listen to this podcast, you're do-it-yourselfer, Vanguardian, probably an engineer type. You handle everything yourself. You've amassed a good amount of wealth, several million dollars. Unfortunately, a lot of that is in IRAs. And you're not going to need the entire RMD. And we're asked all the time, why are they doing this? And the answer is simple. They want their taxes. So they passed a series of rules mandating when you have to start taking money out and establishing the minimum amount. If they didn't have that rule, if they just said at a certain age, you have to start debiting your IRA, people would take a buck out if they didn't need it. Hey, I'm taking money out. So they set the minimum amount that has to come out. And then if you don't take it, ostensibly, they're going to give you what I used to describe as the most severe tax penalty in the U.S. tax code. But I stand corrected now, folks. This is the first thing you're going to learn. It is not the most severe. And we always thought it was because it was 50% of what you were supposed to take out, but didn't. I found, Chris, as I've been geeking, what am I geeking out on lately?
Estate planning, for the most part.
Estate planning. I don't know why, folks, but I am. I found some penalties associated with charitable remainder trust, Chris, that will make your ears curl or hair curl, whatever's supposed to curl in that saying.
Well, it must be my ears because I don't have much hair left.
True. You would have to have your ears curl. And I'm not going to get into it today. I'm going to do it on another day because I just like sharing with you some of the things I'm learning on estate planning. And by you, I mean you, Chris, personally, and our audience as a whole. But anyways, you screw up CRT distributions, charitable remainder trust distributions. The penalty is 200 to 400% of the screw up. It is a serious, serious penalty. So I stand corrected. Oh. There are bigger penalties than the 50% missed RMD penalty. There's a 200 to 400% penalty with CRTs that get messed up. I read a fascinating article on CRTs, a deep article. It was written for attorneys, and it was deep. And I had to read it a few times, but I really geeked out on it. But I was floored by the penalty. CRTs do not mess up a CRT. That's all I can say. Okay, so back to RMDs. If you miss a required minimum distribution, meaning the IRS, is supposed to give you a 50% penalty tax on what you were supposed to take out. As we'll teach you in a minute or later on in the show, we'll explain how to handle that situation. So that's why they created RMDs. They're impatient. They want their taxes. They don't feel like waiting for you to die. So they establish the minimum amount you have to take out. If you don't take it out, they're supposed to give you a 50% penalty tax. Operative word, supposed to. As we'll share with you, most people never actually pay that 50% penalty tax if they have a good excuse. Mm-hmm. Okay. So why don't we get to a little bit, Chris, of when RMDs begin? Why don't you share with our listeners, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I know you know the answer to these. These are easy ones. Explain to them the age that they begin, but what is actually known as your required beginning date, which kind of messes up that first year RMD. And do RMDs or do the quote-unquote rules of RMDs apply only after you reach that certain age you're about to share? Or does it start January 1st of that year, even if you haven't reached that age? Why don't you just share a little bit about all that?
Well, under current law and rules, the RMD age is the year that you turn 72. So technically January 1st of the year that you turn 72, so maybe you haven't turned 72 yet, unless that's your birthday. When you are turning 72 that year, January 1st, you owe the RMD. That very first RMD for that year actually isn't due and payable or due and distributable until your required beginning date, which is defined as April 1st of the year following the year that you reach RMD age. So this would be the following year. Essentially, they give you some grace in that first year. Maybe it's the first year you're needing to take an RMD, and maybe it slips your mind, etc. So that is the relationship there. You can take it anytime after it's due, and actually the first money out of the account at that time is determined to be satisfying the RMD first before anything else. But you do have a little grace until your required beginning date. The second year, it's due by the end of the year. You must take the RMD by December 31st of the year that it's required. So if you do delay that first RMD until the following tax year, you're going to be forced to take two RMDs that year. And so that's when it has to start and how it relates to the required beginning date.
Perfect. And the reason, folks, I asked Chris, when do the rules of RMDs begin? Is this is a very crucial element for all you do-it-yourselfers, especially you do-it-yourselfers who are trying to do forward-looking tax planning and Roth conversions. In the year you turn 72, let's say you were born December 31st, the end of the year. But in the year you turn 72, so beginning January 1st of that year, even though on January 1st, you are still closer to 71 than you are 72. Mm-hmm. You just turned 72 the day before.
You mean 71.
71, sorry. Mm-hmm. The day before. I was testing you. Very good. You're picking up on that.
Thanks.
You just turned 71 the day before. You might think, ah, no problem. I'm not 72 until December 31st. Now you understand why they give you till April 1st. If you don't turn 72 until December 31st, some people might think they can wait to the very end only to find out, oop, I screwed up. Well, they don't want to hit you ostensibly with the quote-unquote 50% penalty, so they give you till April 1st. However, the rules of RMDs apply January 1st of the year you turn 72. Not the year of April 1st of the year following the year you turn 72, but in the year you turn 72. And those rules are simple. Those rules say the first dollars out of your IRA beginning January 1st of the year you turn 72, even if you delay your RMD to the following April 1st, beginning January 1st, the first dollars out are RMD dollars. And RMDs, it's right in the tax code, RMDs cannot be rolled over. You cannot take an RMD from one IRA and move it to another IRA. It's right in the tax code. RMDs cannot be rolled over. But all Roth IRA conversions are considered what, Chris?
They are, in fact, rollovers.
Exactly. Even though you don't think you're doing a rollover, right, the IRS classifies all all Roth conversions as being a rollover. And the tax code says RMDs cannot be rolled over. Therefore, you cannot convert your required minimum distribution to a Roth IRA. Okay, fine and dandy, but where people screw up is when they turn 72. Go back to my example. The person doesn't actually turn 72 until December 31st. It's now January 1st. You Vanguardian, do-it-yourselfer, engineer person sitting there thinking, wow, I'm going to convert again this year. The Trump tax cuts are still in effect. I'm officially retired. My income is down. I'm going to do a big conversion, and you try to do a conversion in January. As soon as the markets reopen, as soon as Vanguard reopens on January 2nd or 3rd, you call them up and you tell them, convert $100,000. Great, you did a big conversion. The problem is, let's just say your required minimum distribution was $110,000. Well, that would be a really, well, no, you could have several million in an IRA. So let's just say your RMD, I will make this more realistic. Your RMD was $60,000, but you went ahead and converted $100,000. You think you're still okay. You'll do your RMD next April. You're going to keep it off of this year's tax return to allow you to do an even bigger conversion. So you're going to postpone that RMD and you think you have time. Well, in my example, I said your RMD is $60,000. In the eyes of the IRS, the first $60,000 of that $100,000 conversion you did was actually the RMD. And RMDs cannot be converted. They just can't be, as I already explained. So now you end up with $60,000 in an Roth IRA that shouldn't be there. And you start getting to a whole host of other issues, which we won't get into. They go beyond the scope of this discussion today. What we want you to know is beginning January 1st of the year you turn 72, RMD rules apply, and the first dollars out of that IRA, even if they were a conversion and you didn't physically take them, doesn't matter. First dollars out are always the RMD, and RMDs cannot be converted. So what is the moral of this story? Do all your conversions prior to 72 or January 1st of 72, or make sure you take the RMD first. Even if you wanted to delay it to April 1st, you're not going to be able to. If you want to convert in the year you turn 72, you've got to take that RMD first, declare it on your taxes, and convert on top of that.
Yep.
Okay, so that's a couple of the rules. How do you actually determine the RMD? It's fairly straightforward, except for difficult to value assets, which we'll get into later. So let's just assume we're talking for the sake of you Vanguardians. Your Vanguard IRA, you've got it there. It's at Vanguard. It's very easy to value. You can see at a moment's notice. You can log on or open the app and see right to the second what your IRA is worth. What are they going to make you use for the value, Chris, as far as RMDs go?
Well, it's defined in the code, the rules, that you must use the ending balance on the last day of the previous year to determine the RMD. So it's the account balance, December 31st of the year prior to the RMD being due.
Okay, so if your RMDs are supposed to begin here in 2022, say you turn 72 in 2022, you use the December 31st value of 2021 to figure out your 2022 RMD. Now, keep that in mind. If you defer that first RMD until April 1st of 2023. As we already said, you have to take two RMDs that year. But one RMD is the one you delayed, and that is based on the December 31st, 2021 account value. So when you take that RMD the following year by April 1st, you still have to, even though you're taking it in 2023, you still have to call it your 2022 RMD, which is based on your year-end 2021 account balance. So don't mess up on that. You can't use your year-end 2022 account balance for that missed or skipped RMD. You still have to use the 2021. And that's the first RMD out when you delay your required minimum distributions. It is always going to be the delayed one first, and then the required one for that year is next. Did I explain that okay, or do you need to add any clarity anywhere?
No, I think because that is a confusing point for some people. They think, well, if I'm delaying it now till April 1st, I'm delaying that very first RMD, the only one that can be delayed into the next year, and they get confused and maybe use the, you know, in our example, we're talking about a 2022 RMD. If you waited till April 1st of 23 to take it, some people might want to use the December 31st of 22 value, and that's not true. The way to always think about it is the RMD for any given year is determined on January 1st of that year. Regardless of when you actually take it, the dollar amount is determined first thing in the morning, if you want to think of that, January 1st of that year. You just might delay it that very long time, that 15 months until April 1st of the year following the year you turn 72, but it was all determined way back in January 1st based on that December 31st value of, in our example, 2021. So don't make that mistake. Even if you're going to delay that first one, it doesn't change the calculation. It just changes when you have to take it.
Okay. So how is the calculation actually done or determined? That has to do with who the beneficiary of your IRA is. There's going to be two tables that you may have to go to. You're going to have to go to one of the two. There's technically three tables, but one table is after you die. It's the inherited table, and we're not talking about that today. We spent a lot of time talking about inherited IRAs and the single life table. Today, we're talking about RMDs when you're alive. So there's two tables that you would look at. One is called the Uniform Lifetime Table, and the other is called the Joint Life Table. When would you use each table? Well, if your sole beneficiary is your primary beneficiary, is your spouse, and your spouse is more than 10 years younger than you. In other words, she's 10 years and a day, or he is 10 years and a day, or 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years younger than you. You will use the Uniform Lifetime Table. But if your beneficiary is primary beneficiary is a non-spouse, or there's no beneficiary, which is a bad thing to do, but people do that, or it's your spouse, but he or she is not more than 10 years younger than you. They're 9 years younger than you, 8 years, 7 years, 6 years younger than you. You go to the Uniform Lifetime Table. So most people will use the Uniform Lifetime Table. The Joint Life Table can only be used when a spouse is the sole primary beneficiary. You can't name your son or daughter as beneficiary thinking you're going to be able to use the more favorable Uniform Lifetime Table because they're more than 10 years younger than you. Does not work that way. Has to be a spouse as beneficiary, sole primary beneficiary. And in the Uniform Lifetime Table, it's fairly straightforward. You have an X and a Y axis. You're going to find the age of you on the X or the Y. It doesn't matter. You're going to find your age on one of the axes, the spouse's age on the other axis. Did I say that right? Axis or?
Axis.
Axis.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Or plural is axes.
Y'all know what I meant.
Yeah, we all know what you meant.
You're going to find them, and you just go, I do it literally with my fingers, and I just draw my fingers together, and where they touch is going to be a number, and that number is going to be your divisor, and it's the life expectancy, according to the IRS, of two people at that exact set of ages. But the Uniform Lifetime Table was designed to make things simpler. Rather than having to do that for all these different ages, the IRS said, look, for anyone within, any spouse within 10 years of your age, or if you have no IRA beneficiary, or if you name someone who's not a spouse as beneficiary, in any of these examples, we're going to simplify it. We are going to determine the life expectancy of two people, and the second person is always exactly 10 years younger than the first person. And then they only have to look at one table with just a few sets of numbers in it. So that's called the Uniform Lifetime Table. Again, you will use it if you have no beneficiary or a non-spouse beneficiary or a spouse who's not more than 10 years younger than you. So you go to that table and you look up your age. Now, here's where some people make a mistake. Let's go back to my original example, folks, of someone who turned 72 this year, 2022, but not till December 31st. Today, as we record this, it's July 21st, 3 days from a very important person's birthday. Do you know who that is, Chris?
Abe Lincoln.
No. Try again. Very, very, very important person in your life. 3 more days from today, it is that person's birthday.
The guy that makes coffee for me every morning at Dutch Bros.
No.
He's very important to me.
I'm sure he is. This person is even more important to you. You may not believe it.
Oh, I may not believe it. That clarifies it's got to be you.
Exactly. Of course, I'm much more important than your Dutch brothers. Look at
that. You've got a nice birthday on a weekend now. You can have all kind of festivities.
I guess my birthday is this coming Sunday.
Yeah, nice.
Okay, so back to my example, folks. Let's say someone was born turning 72 December 31st, 2022, but today they take their RMD, July 21st, 2022. And technically right now they're 71.
Right.
So if you go to the Uniform Lifetime Table, there is a life expectancy there for someone who's 71. You don't use it.
Right.
You've got to use your age in the year. The oldest you'll be in that year, even if you're not there yet.
So the age you'll be the last day of the year.
Correct, yep. Which will be 72. So it's the same thing. Let's say you're 78 and you're taking your RMD, but you're still 77. Doesn't matter. You've got to use 78. And the reason that rule exists is easy. Everybody would take it before their actual birthday so they can use a smaller divisor and take out a smaller RMD. IRS is onto that. Your uncle is onto that. They want the biggest minimum amount possible coming out. So they simply say, doesn't matter. You have to use your age at the end of the year. So simply straightforward. You're going to go to that single life table. The uniform lifetime table. For a 72-year-old, it's 27.4 is the divisor. So then you're going to go to your December 31st, 2021 IRA balance the year before. You're taking your RMD in 2022. You're looking at 2021's. You're going to take that December 31st balance, whatever it may be. You're going to divide it by 27.4, and that's the minimum amount you have to take out.
Yep.
Clear enough?
Clear enough.
Clear enough. And then, of course, on the joint life tables, you have to look at your age that year, the spouse's age that year, and do that little finger thing on the X and Y, come across, and you will have a more specific distribution table that is generally going to always will be lower than the uniform lifetime table, because the second life is more than 10 years younger than you, and the uniform lifetime table is based on someone exactly 10 years younger than you. So you do get a more favorable distribution. If favorable means the smaller amount, using the joint life table is more favorable. So don't forget to use that, folks, if you qualify for it. Anything else you want to add?
No. I think you pointed out something important, or at least that would reduce stress in this, that most people with these accounts, not necessarily most people that listen to this show, but most people with these accounts end up taking out well in excess of their RMD every year. So they really don't have to worry too much about these rules. Their natural behavior is handling this. And if that's you, you don't have to fuss about this too much. But if you are in that case where you're taking it out because of the rules and not so much because you want to or need to take it out for spending, you've got to pay attention to this so that you don't under distribute. Or the cardinal foul, if you will, is converting, doing something that, you not only are you not distributing it, but you're doing something that's expressly prohibited, and things get really messy at that point. So it's important to know these rules if you're subject to them, recognizing that a lot of people with these accounts are not really going to be effectively affected by them because of that point, that they just aren't big enough to be creating an RMD that's bigger than what they're taking out anyway, which is a sad note, I will say, in that. That just kind of emphasizes the fact that most Americans are underprepared for retirement, and they're distributing far more than is likely sustainable out of these accounts in too many cases. Be nice if everyone's balances were so large that they were all being, having to pay attention to these RMD rules because they just simply didn't need as much money coming out to do the things that they wanted. They'd be in a much better position financially. But that's quite a tangent. I'll stop there.
That's okay. We don't mind. Okay. So let's move on to some other issues with required minimum distributions. How do you value, well, wait a minute. How do you, do I want to do the value or the, no, let's talk about this first before I get into the valued assets. Who's responsible for determining the RMD? The custodian or you? Now, who do you, well, I know you know the answer to this, Chris. Mm-hmm. Who's responsible for determining the RMD?
Unfortunately, the burden falls upon the you, the account holder. You're ultimately responsible. Custodians, as a generosity, if you will oftentimes help you with this, but ultimately it is your burden to make sure that it is the correct amount and have done the calculation correctly. But like I said, a lot of custodians do it as a courtesy, but I think you'll read in their fine print that they may not know the full story. It's ultimately up to you, yada, 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 in that. And that is true. It's ultimately yours. And if there's a mistake made, it falls on you.
Okay. And that is correct. But there's one small nuance to that. And I knew you knew this, Chris. The IRS did pass a rule saying custodians must assist in determining the RMD. They must provide that to you if you request it. Mm-hmm. Most, as Chris rightly pointed out, will do it and send it to you without you having to request it. But get a load of this, folks. Yeah. The custodian is required to help you determine the RMD, but they are not required to get it right.
Right.
You are.
And that's where the whole story comes into this. They obviously are only doing calculations based on what they know, and they may not know about all your IRAs, and therefore are working with less than full information. So that's why they are going to always hedge their responsibilities, if you will. Yes, they divulge this, which is good, because you need the information from the custodian to do these calculations, and they'll do the math for you. It's simple division. But that's, you just have to always remember, ultimately it's on you. Ultimately it's on you to make sure it's correct.
Absolutely, not the custodian. If the custodian got it wrong, that's not a defense. Well, ostensibly, it's not a defense. I'm sure you would still be able to get forgiveness, and we'll talk about that when we explain.
So practically, it's not as scary as maybe I just made it sound, but I think if people realize they need to take responsibility for it, then they'll never have to be asking for forgiveness.
Right. As Dad always says, the custodians are responsible to helping you figure it out. They are not responsible for getting it right.
Right.
You are. So you should double check the work is what I'm getting at to make sure it's being done correctly. Most people, 99.9% of people are just going to rely on what the custodian tells them, and 99.9% of the time they're going to get it right. But where mistakes sometimes get made is often, not necessarily all the time, but often it's in the favor of the IRS, not in your favor. And what do I mean by that? It means just what Chris said. Custodians don't know what you're doing with all your other accounts. So they may tell you, well, this is what you have to take out of my IRA that you have with us. But you may have five IRAs total. And in one other IRA, you took out way more than you needed to take out of that IRA. Well, the custodians don't know there's excess RMDs, because excess RMDs from one IRA, I don't want to use the word excess RMD, excess distribution beyond the minimum you had to take out of that IRA. Any excess beyond the minimum for that IRA can be used to offset distributions in other IRAs you have. That's called aggregation. And there's aggregation rules. The rules state IRAs can aggregate their RMDs. So just humor me, folks. You have three separate IRAs for some reason. we run into that every now and then. People maintain separate IRAs,
yeah,
and they have their reasons. So you have three IRAs. And let's just again say they have the exact same dollar amount and the exact same RMD, which is $5,000. So $5,000 has to come out of those IRAs, $5,000 from each one. You calculate each RMD separately and you add it together, and that's your aggregated RMD, but it need not come from each IRA separately. You don't have to take five from IRA 1, five from IRA 2, and five from IRA 3. You can take it all from IRA 3. So you could take $15,000 from IRA 3, and you will have satisfied all the RMDs for the other two IRAs. So IRA RMDs can be aggregated. Custodians don't know if you're doing that. Custodians don't know if you've taken excess out. So if you just rely on what the custodian says, and they might tell you, yeah, you have to take $5,000 out of this IRA. Would you like us to do it for you? Oh, sure. Please send it to me. But if you aren't remembering that you took money beyond the RMDs from other IRAs, you could run into a situation where you took more out than you had to. And that's favorable to the IRS, in their opinion, because they got more taxes. You took out more than you needed to. So it's not just going to be that you screw the IRS and take out less than you needed to. And that's why they're saying to custodians, you're not responsible, the person is. The IRS is actually saying that to custodians because they don't want to burden custodians with trying to track all your other accounts. They're putting that burden on you. So that's called aggregation. So let's bleed this over now into 401ks, because I said most of these rules are similar, but not totally. Let's say you have three 401ks. Each, again, with the same dollar amount and the same RMD, $5,000 from each. And they're at three former employers. And in one 401k, you took $15,000 out. For one reason or another, you took $15,000 out. So you more than satisfied the RMD for that 401k. In fact, you took out enough to satisfy the RMD for the other two 401ks. But there's one problem. The IRS does not let you aggregate 401ks. So you still have to take $5,000 from 401k2 and $5,000 from 401k3 on top of the $15,000 you already took. And if you don't need the money, you're being stuck taking $25,000 out even though you didn't have to, because you have to take an RMD from each 401k. 401ks cannot be aggregated. 403bs cannot be aggregated. Excuse me, 457 plans cannot be aggregated. 403bs can be aggregated. I don't know why they can, and the other employer-sponsored accounts can't. So aggregation rules, I call them aggravation rules. Why? Well, if you have three, four, five employer plans, you're going to start getting aggravated. That's a tough one to decide between aggravated and aggregated. Right. That's a tough one. But I call them aggravated rules, because you cannot combine all those employer plans and simplify your life. You're going to be having to take out multiple RMDs from multiple employer plans for the rest of your life. So there is a reason to consolidate your employer plans as you retire. You want to simplify your life for the older you. I know all you do-it-yourself engineer, Vanguardian, Excel spreadsheet crunching people don't think there's ever going to come a time where you're not going to want to or be able to handle this. But trust me, someday you won't want to deal with it, or someday you won't be able to deal with it, or sadly, someday you won't be here to handle it, and you're going to be leaving that to a spouse who's not going to have any idea how to handle it. So aggregating your 401ks to get rid of the aggravation of having to deal with multiple 401ks is a very wise thing you may want to consider, because you can't aggregate 401ks. Now you try saying aggregate and aggravate.
Aggregate and aggravate?
Aggregate. See, you kind of messed up a little, I think. Just say it 10 times real fast.
No, this isn't that kind of test.
But anyways, that's what I often call 401ks. You can't aggregate them, and that becomes aggregating.
Aggravating.
Aggravating. See, I can't say it. I don't even know why I'm trying.
This whole conversation is aggravating.
Regularly. Exactly. The whole conversation is aggravating. Anyways, folks, keep those rules in mind and try to simplify your life. 401ks, IRAs can be aggregated, and so can 403Bs for some bizarre reason, but not with IRAs.
Right, not with each other.
Right. There's no intermingling here in the eyes of the government when it comes to retirement accounts. You can't take a 403B and an IRA and say, okay, I'm going to take the RMD from the 403B. Cannot do that. And IRAs can never satisfy the RMDs from any other type of account except for another IRA. Okay. Any questions on any of that?
No, I think we made it through that, as uncomfortable as it might have been.
I don't think it was that uncomfortable.
Well, it's aggravating. I think this is one of those areas where the rule differentials between 401ks and IRAs are just ripe for mistakes to be made by people who don't want to spend a ton of brain power figuring this all out and following all these one-off rules. So it is, there are steps you can take, and we are big fans here of simplification as you move through retirement. So you can reduce your aggravation on a lot of these things by consolidation. Here's another Asian word, and get your money in accounts that can be then brought together in aggregation rules for things like RMDs. There's lots of other areas where consolidation can make perfect sense, or it isn't so much consolidation. It's taking steps to simplify your life as you move through retirement so that you're not caught up and you don't expose yourself to these gotchas in some of these rules. It's just not needed. And even if the penalty isn't that big, it's the aggravation piece that Jim kept mentioning that's the big problem. There's plenty of things that you need to be off enjoying and doing and receiving the focus in your life in retirement rather than tiptoeing through this minefield of rules. So take steps to simplify and avoid these kind of gotchas. That's, you know, one of our main mantras, if you will.
Okay, so what happens with all of this? You still mess up. A mistake is made, and you missed some required minimum distributions. It happens. We see it a lot. Happens a lot of times with elderly people. At some point in time, you might start forgetting. And you can go 2, 3, 4, 5 years and totally forgot that you never took it. Or you forgot about an IRA that you had and you weren't calculating that IRA in. We see things like that, believe it or not. But for one reason or another, you may have messed up and missed a required minimum distribution. Well, the penalty is supposed to be 50% of what you didn't take out. So if you were supposed to take out $60,000 and you only took out $30,000 for some reason, you will owe a $15,000 penalty tax, and you still have to take the full $60,000 out. The penalty tax is not part of the distribution. It's in addition to the distribution. So you still have to take the $60,000 out and pay taxes on that. And they're going to add, in my example, a $15,000 penalty tax on top of it. 50%, not of the total RMD, unless you missed the total RMD, but 50% of what you should have taken out but didn't. And again, prior to reading that article on CRTs, I honestly thought it was the most significant or serious or onerous penalty in the tax code until I found the 200 and 400% penalty that I'll teach everybody about with CRTs in the future.
Yep.
Okay. Now, that said, I have never met anyone. It's kind of like the Yeti. You hear about it, but you don't really ever see one. I have heard about this 50% penalty, but I have never experienced someone who actually had to pay it. I have helped many people avoid paying it, but I've never seen anyone who actually had to pay it. And that's important to keep in mind because of Secure 2, what we call Son of Secure, that is working its way through Congress. And I do think it will become law this year. Politicians will get together and most likely pass that. It has very little opposition in both the House and Senate. And Secure 2 lowers the 50% penalty to just 10%. Sounds really harmless, 10%. And then there's different tiers. If I remember correctly, I'm not sure which version is going to make it. There may be a 25% penalty in there for some things, and then other reasons that don't fall into the higher penalty amount can get a 10% penalty. That was one explanation I saw that they're contemplating. But unique is this, and Ed Slott himself said to us at the last class, but I have said this on the podcast many times, few people, if any, ever pay the 50% penalty. And we'll explain to you in a minute how to avoid it and why most people don't ever have to pay it. And as Ed said, zero of 50% doesn't give the government much money, but 100% of 10% will. Mm-hmm. Under Secure, there is no forgiveness. You miss an RMD, it's a 10% penalty no matter what. So that's what makes Secure not, to me, it is a tax increase, and it looks like a massive tax reduction. Right. Looks like the IRS and the government is being so nice because that 50% penalty was just so horrendous. Even though, as Ed said, no one ever paid it. 50% of zero is a lot less than 10% of 100%.
Right.
Under Secure, there will be no more forgiveness for missed RMDs.
Secure
just
too.
Pay the 10% and move on. Okay, so why do we say nobody pays it? Because getting out of it is quite easy as long as you have a legit reason. I am sure there's people out there who had to pay this because the IRS realized they were playing with the system. They were not being honest. It wasn't a genuine mistake.
To ask for forgiveness and just paid it. A lot of people just
know.
Say,
correct.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, gee, that sucks. I won't do that again. And they pay it. So there's probably a few of those that happened. But anybody who wants to challenge it, it's been pretty successful.
Right. And you challenge it on Form 5329. So if you miss an RMD and assuming you weren't really trying to play the system, here's what you do. And it's not difficult. I've done this many a times. You do-it-yourselfers can do it yourself. It's not rocket science. You're going to go to Form 5329. Well, actually, before you even do that, the first thing you have to do, and this all comes to part of asking for forgiveness, immediately take the missed RMD or RMDs plural. If you are more likely than not, you'll discover perhaps your parent or parents have missed some RMDs as they've aged. which is not uncommon. And that's one of the reasons few elderly people ever paid the 50% penalty. The IRS knows we become forgetful as we get older. So the first thing you do is immediately take the missed RMD or the missed RMDs, plural, you take them. So let's just say you discovered a missed RMD in 2022 that your parents missed in 2019. Just making these dates up. Well, 2022 is a real date. Just making 2019 up. You immediately take the missed 2019 RMD. The good news is you don't have to file an amended return for 2019. The IRS says just declare it as income in the year you discovered the mistake. So you will take the 2019 missed RMD for your parent, and you will make sure it gets put on their 2022 taxes. And you still have to take the 2022 RMD. That missed one doesn't make up for this one. So that's the first thing you immediately do. Trust me on this. Take the missed RMD immediately. That's going to go a long way to getting your forgiveness. Then you'd get Form 5329. But you have to use the Form 5329 from the year of the missed RMD. You do not have to file this form with your tax return. So you don't have to wait until the 2022 tax return to file the forgiveness, if you will. 5329 is the only tax form that requires its own signature. It's not attached to a 1040. It can be filed separately. And that makes the statute of limitations a moot point with a missed RMD. You can't say, oh, my mother missed the 2019 one. It is now 2022. It's 3 years from when she missed it. I get the statute of limitations. We're good to go. Or what if she missed the 2016 one, and now it's 6 years, and you think, oh, statute of limitations, way past. We don't have to worry about it. No. And the reason is the tax courts have ruled, and the IRS position is, because 5329, the form that you report a missed RMD on, requires its own signature, the statute of limitations doesn't apply. In fact, it won't begin until you actually file Form 5329 reporting the missed RMD. Then the statute of limitations begins. Anything you want to add on any of that, Chris, so far?
No. And I think that the process, again, it's an aggravation because you have to file that, but you can get out of it at least up and until they change the rules on this and remove the ability to ask for forgiveness. But we'll see how that plays out. We'll certainly keep everybody apprised of the status if that changes over time. But as long as you get that format right, keep it short and simple, follow the steps. Most people have been very, very successful getting forgiveness on those.
Perfect. Now, a person much, much smarter than Chris and I even, Natalie, is it Choate or Choate? I always screw up her name. Choate. Mm-hmm. Natalie Choate, who's a Boston area attorney who specializes in retirement plans and retirement distributions and taxes and all of that. She has kind of a suggestion. Now, I've never done it. She claims she does it, and she is over 72. But she said, and you were at the course where she was first, I heard her talk about this, Chris.
Right.
She said she files Form 5329 for her and her clients every year with a big fat zero on it, mm-hmm. saying, hey, I didn't make any mistakes. Everything's right. Big fat zero, and signs it and dates it and sends it in. And she says, in her opinion, that does start the statute of limitations clock. So if something was missed or done wrong, assuming it wasn't fraudulent, which doesn't have any statute of limitations, it was a genuine mistake, and you weren't trying to fraudulently get out of taking any RMDs, thinking I'm going to skip RMDs, I'm just going to file 5329 each year, and I'll be safe once I hit a 3-year period. No, it doesn't work that way. That's fraud. So she files form 5329 with a big fat zero and signs it and says, I made no mistakes. Just in case she did do something generally wrong, she thinks the statute of limitations would then apply. Anyways, just something she shared with us. Don't know if you want to follow it or not, but that was one of her thoughts and recommendations. So anyways, you'll go to the 2019 form 5329 in my example, because your parent missed the 2019 RMD. You're going to go to the, it's only a 2-page form. You're going to go to the second page right at the bottom. It's the very last one. It's section 9 now, older or younger, if you will, 5329s. I think prior to 2015 only had 8 sections. They added another section for HSA accounts, I think, but I can't remember. But anyways, in section 9 is where you will write or disclose the missed RMD. And it's only 4 lines. Line 52, you're going to look at line 52 and it asks, what was the required minimum distribution for the year you missed? And you're going to put that dollar amount down. Let's just say your mom was supposed to have taken $50,000. So you would write $50,000 down. And then it says amount actually distributed. Let's say your mom totally missed the 2019 RMD. You're going to put zero because she didn't take anything. And then the next line, it says subtract line 53 from, excuse me, subtract line 52 from line 53. Or in other words, subtract zero from $50,000. And then you have to write that number down. Chris, what number are you going to write down in that box?
This is government for you. You're going to write zero.
Exactly. Because
which those of us who learned math in second grade know that 5,300 minus zero is still 5,300 or whatever he said.
Yeah. No, 50,000 minus zero is still 50,000.
Right.
But you write zero because you are filing 5329 to bring to the attention to the IRS. Your mom messed up in this case, or it could have been you, whoever messed up. Hey, there was a mistake made. The mistake was made in 2019. That's why you're using the 5329 from 2019. The mistake was made in 2019. Here's what it is. We were supposed to take 50 grand out. We took zero. But we are writing zero down where we do that math, the subtraction of what you took out from what you were supposed to take out. We're still putting zero. And then in the margins, right next to box 54, in the margins is a little dotted line. And you're going to put, excuse me, you're going to put RC. And what is that, Chris?
Requesting compassion. That's my version. I think it makes more sense.
That, I always hand that off to Chris because he came up with that. When I first told him you put RC in the margins,
I'm sticking
said,
to mine. Yeah.
Requesting compassion, because that's essentially what you're doing, folks. If you do the math, you got 50,000 minus zero. You should write 50,000 on that third line because the fourth line says take 50% of the line above, and that is your penalty tax you owe us. Well, 50% of zero is zero. But 50% of $50,000 would have been $25,000. You put a zero down. You're essentially telling the government, I don't think I owe anything. Or I don't think my mom owes anything. So you put zero. And in the margins, you have to write RC. It does not stand for requesting compassion. But I love that. I think that's so cute. It actually stands for reasonable cause. Right. You are telling the IRS, look, a mistake was made, but we have a reason. And now what you do is you attach a letter to Form 5329 explaining what went wrong. That letter, literally, and I kid you not, folks, I have done several, well, many of these. I can't even remember how many. I am pithy as pithy can be, and you would think my letters would be 16 pages all indexed and footnoted. No. It is three very short paragraphs. The first paragraph, what happened? I discovered that my mom did not take her 2019 required minimum distribution, and then explain why. Let's just say your mom was in the hospital that year. She had a very bad medical condition. Because she was in the hospital for 6 months or whatever the case may be. You're going to put that in the first paragraph. Second paragraph, what did you do about it? We immediately took the required minimum distribution in 2022. We will declare it on her 2022 taxes and pay all associated taxes or however you're going to word it. That's why I said you immediately do it. That's what they want to see. They don't want to read in paragraph two, we've left it in there until you tell us what you're going to do, if we're going to owe the penalty or not. They don't want to see that, folks, at all. So you immediately take it out and you reference that in the second paragraph. Third paragraph, what did you do to make sure this never happens again? That is what the third paragraph needs to say to placate them. To keep this from happening again, I have asked her IRA custodian to start sending duplicate copies to her three children so we can watch that this doesn't occur anymore. That's all you need to do. What happened? What did you do about it? What are you going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again? That's all you need to do. You attach it to the 5329 and you send it off. And chances are you will not have to pay the penalty. But under Secure 2, it's just going to be 10% on all missed RMDs. Okay. I think we covered that enough. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So let's just wrap it up with the email that got me thinking about all of this. Okay, this email came in last week, and it's what gave me the idea of doing another EDU show on RMDs, because we haven't done one in a while, at least on RMDs when you're alive, the easy RMDs. Because this part makes it a little bit more difficult, and that has to do with difficult-to-value assets. What a lot of people don't realize is pretty much anything can be held inside an IRA except life insurance and collectibles.
Yep.
Other than that, you can hold it inside an IRA. And a lot of people do have difficult to value assets. Now, for you Vanguardian do-it-yourselfers, you most likely have a lot of Vanguard ETFs and index holdings and things of that nature. Very, very easy to value. Individual stocks, individual bonds, ETFs, mutual funds. Very, very easy to value. Now, you start getting into some of the more esoteric investments, say private placements or private REITs. Now, private REITs are a little bit different. The IRS mandates they be valued a little bit more accurately, but for years before that, they were difficult to actually value. What if you've purchased real estate inside an IRA? Not anything we generally recommend because it's always messed up, but assuming you did want to do it for one reason or another, and you have real estate inside an IRA, that can be difficult to value. Difficult to value assets are hard to determine RMDs on. Well, there's another asset that can be held inside an IRA that can make not only the valuation difficult but easy to find, it can make the actual RMD calculation hard. And that's a variable annuity. And, well, let me read the email and you'll understand where I'm going with this, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay, it says, hi, Jim, Chris, and Bob. It says, when I retired at 57, I had a wealth manager. And he says with what company, I'm not going to name it. It's one of the big wirehouses. Y'all have heard of it, trust me. I had a wealth manager, but now I manage my assets on my own. And I have been doing IRA conversions to Roths. But the wealth management team, when I worked with them, bought a variable annuity for me inside my traditional IRA that was funded with money from a 401k that I rolled over. When I annuitize it next year, it will pay me $2,000 a month for life. And the balance will go to my beneficiaries. But here is my question. How will RMDs and a variable annuity work? And what is the basis for me in determining my required minimum distribution? I love your podcast. Jim is spectacular. I hope that gets me to the question of the week. Now, that didn't get him to the question of the week, but rampant and blatant butt kissing can get you everywhere in this business. Just want to point that out.
That's the downside of all these emails running through Jim.
I'm very shallow. It doesn't take much to impress me. But then he did put, he says, I'm just kidding. Everyone on the team is spectacular. Okay. This sounds like a simple question, but he's got a lot of moving parts here. First of all, let's go back to, generally speaking, difficult to value assets. If you have difficult to value assets in your 401k, you...
IRA.
In your IRA, the IRA custodian is the one who has to determine the value of those assets. They are not supposed to take your word for it. That used to be the rules. The IRS changed it in 2015 because people would say, yeah, that's worth $2,000. And even though they put $200,000 into the investment. So the IRS is like, nope, the custodian now has to determine it. If there is a cost associated with determining the value of the asset, the IRA has to cover that cost. You cannot cover out of your own pocket. You have to make sure the IRA has money in it to get a valuation. Mostly on real estate, this is an issue. Because if you have real estate, you have a rental property. So you have to get a because you can't be living it in your own house. You can't have your own house in there. So you most likely have a rental. So you have to get commercial appraisals, which are expensive. Some custodians will accept the tax valuation from the county or city in which your property is in, but some custodians won't, and they're going to want an actual appraisal. And it can start getting expensive every year because you have to have the appraisal done and valued for December 31st of the previous year, not what it's worth today. You might be in 2022 trying to get an appraiser so you can take your 2022 RMD. They have to appraise it based on what it was worth on December 31st of 2021. That can be dramatically different than what it's worth on the day they're making the appraisal. This is what starts to get difficult with hard-to-value assets. So do keep that in mind. For those of you who are trying to own unique, little cute things inside your IRA. When RMDs begin, it's going to be a nightmare. And do not cross the line. You cannot pay for the appraisal. You cannot do the appraisal. You shouldn't even be hiring the appraiser. These are things that the custodian needs to do. You have to stay at arm's length away from this. But let's look at 401ks. Excuse me. Let's look at variable annuities. I do want to point out a few things. If this person who was working with this wealth management firm, what we call a wire house, and again, There's only a handful of wirehouses out there. You will have, you will, everybody will recognize the name of this firm. I hope they told you to move your 401k into an IRA and buy a variable annuity solely for that income benefit and for no other reason. Because there is no reason to hold an annuity inside an IRA for tax purposes. They're treated the same. They're both tax deferred. It has to be that the annuity has an income benefit that was valuable to you. And he does reference, Chris, a $2,000 a month income benefit. But he says the annuity is going to be annuitized.
Right.
I highly doubt it.
Yep. I was thinking the same thing. And that makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference. So remember, folks, annuitization is a action. It's a verb. When you annuitize, it's a verb. The annuity is a noun, but you're going to turn it into a verb by doing something. What are you going to do? You're going to tell the annuity company, hey, my wealth manager sold me this variable annuity inside my IRA. And they said, as long as I hold it for X amount of years or whatever, I can get income. I can get $2,000 a month for the rest of my life. If the annuity company then took the value of your annuity, and I don't know what you have in the annuity, several hundred thousand dollars, I'm going to guess. Annuitization means the annuity company takes that money.
Right.
It's no longer yours. It's theirs.
Right.
And they replaced it with a $2,000 a month guarantee. Mm-hmm.
On one hand, that's good news when they do that for this conversation, because it makes the RMD easy for that account, in that the RMD becomes whatever the income, the annuitized payment is, and you don't have to do any calculations. The payment is the RMD. You can't aggregate using that now, but that deals with this issue because there's no more account balance anymore. So there's no more December 31st account balance for you even to calculate an RMD. So they make it simple and say, we declare, that's the IRS using their powers, essentially, we declare that the RMD shall be the annuitized payment itself, no further calculations required. So in one regard, that piece gets simple. I doubt, as you are, that that's the relation, the situation with this particular annuity, though, because of everything he said about it.
Right. And what Chris and I are getting at is we firmly believe, we could be wrong, correct us, listener, if we're wrong, if it's actually annuitized. And it's not impossible to find variable annuities sold by a broker that must be annuitized. I recently came across one, but it was purchased a very long time ago. And this variable annuity had to be annuitized to get any type of income benefit. But that's very rare. More likely than not, listener, you have a broker-sold annuity that will have high fees and a commission and all of that. It is what it is. It's not the issue here. You purchased it, I hope, specifically for the income benefit. I'm hoping they determined for you the minimum income benefit, which you're telling us now it's $2,000 a month is what you're getting. We hope that the annuity was offered to you with the knowledge it was going to pay you exactly $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year beginning in 2022, that they crunched the numbers and showed you that you will need at least that much money. And they also showed you that there was no better option out there. Let's just hope all of that was done. Mm-hmm. So now you have this annuity. My gut tells me you actually have a variable annuity with a withdrawal benefit. Mm-hmm. That is totally different than an annuitized benefit. Even if that annuity that you purchased, I don't know how many years ago, has an annuitization option where you could tell the company, take my assets, give me income. It can still have an annuitization option, but my gut tells me it also has what the industry calls a withdrawal benefit, where the insurance company will say, hey, you, let's just pretend, Chris, there's $200,000 in the annuity now. I don't know what it is. But the insurance company will say, hey, rather than giving us the $200,000 and us promising you this much money for the rest of your life, you can keep the $200,000. And as long as you don't remove more than $2,000 a month or $24,000 a year as a withdrawal from that annuity, which is inside an IRA. So from that IRA, as long as you don't take more than $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year out of that annuity, we will continue to pay you $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year, if you live long enough and the account balance in that annuity reaches zero. And I think that's what he has, because he references at his death. He doesn't say the income payments continue. He says at my passing, the balance, if any, will go to my beneficiaries.
Right.
So it's telling me he has that type of annuity, a withdrawal benefit.
Right.
That annuity will have been opened directly at the insurance company. So you have an IRA at the insurance company, and inside that IRA is this variable annuity. That's most likely the setup. Even if you still are with this wirehouse and you still get statements from them, and this annuity looks like it's on a consolidated statement, my gut tells me it was opened separately at the insurance company, and the statement is just kind of feeding in from the insurance company the value of that annuity, as well as the other assets that that wirehouse broker might still be managing for you. So you, in my example, listener, I'm pretending you have $200,000 in this annuity. It is most likely an IRA off to itself, by itself, sitting there. And you're asking, how does the RMDs work with this? Well, here's where it gets interesting, if you will. If you did have $200,000 in it, and the divisor is 27.4, because we know that, we just looked at the uniform lifetime table for a 72-year-old, what is 200,000 divided by 27.4, Chris?
It is 7,299.
So 7,299.
Yes.
Okay. So $7,299. Let's just call it 7,300. It's a nice rounder number. Mm-hmm. So 7,300, listener, is the RMD associated with that $200,000 annuity IRA if you were age 72. These numbers are probably wrong because you didn't give them to me, but follow the instruction, the logic. So you have a $7,300 RMD, but you're taking 24 grand out of that annuity. Chances are that annuity has a hell of a lot more money than 200,000 in it. Again, I don't have a calculator. What's 24,000 minus 7,200?
24 minus 7,300 is $16,700.
Okay, so you're taking $16,700 more out of that annuity. Again, I know these numbers are wrong, but follow the math. That is an excess withdrawal.
Not a bad thing, just excess above the RMD required for that account.
Correct. But because IRAs can be consolidated, that 16,700 you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That 16,700 can go to reducing RMDs from other IRAs you may own. So a withdrawal benefit from RMD purposes is often beneficial because the first year RMD is about a 3.7-ish withdrawal if you broke the 27.4 into a percentage. It's about 3.7, 3.8-ish percent. Most withdrawal annuities begin at payments higher than that,
right.
4 or 5%. Some are 6 or 7, some older ones. So they give you, at least initially in the RMD world, a calculation, significantly more than what you have to take out as the minimum required distribution. And since IRAs can be consolidated, the excess RMD from that withdrawal benefit can reduce RMDs from other IRAs you may have.
And just to be clear for people following along, when Jim's saying consolidated, he's meaning the same thing in this context to when we were talking about aggregated.
Oh, I'm
I just
sorry.
Want to make
yes.
sure that people understand that that's we're talking about the same thing here.
Yeah, I should have used the same word, but aggregated aggravates me. So
yeah.
I figured I would say consolidated. Sure. So IRAs can be aggregated. So you are allowed to use the excess. You might be sitting there, why? Why can you do this in a withdrawal annuity, which is going to pay $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year for the rest of someone's life, but you couldn't do it if he annuitized it into an income stream that pays $2,000 a month, $24,000 a year for the rest of your life? Under the annuitization rules, that $24,000 is only considered an RMD for that annuity IRA and cannot be used anywhere else. But in a withdrawal benefit, you can use it to offset other RMDs. Don't overanalyze it, folks. The answer is right in front of your face. Chris, whose money is the insurance company giving this listener?
They're giving you your own money back. It's just a withdrawal of that account balance that you have in there.
Exactly. It's not magic, folks. In a withdrawal annuity, in my example, he has $200,000 in it. My gut tells me he has more than that, but he has $200,000 in there. He's going to take $24,000 out. It's his own money. He has a remaining balance in there of about, what, $176,000? So he's got $176,000, assuming no growth ever happened in that annuity. It's only his money he took. Next year, they're only going to give him his money again. They're going to take $24,000 out of his IRA annuity. It's a withdrawal benefit. They're saying as long as you don't withdraw more than what we tell you you can withdraw, we will continue to pay you this if you live long enough and your money runs out. Now, in a perfect world, listener, I don't want you to die with any money in that annuity for your beneficiaries. And I am serious on that because you have paid a boatload of money over the years for that annuity because you bought it from a wirehouse. It was broker sold. I guarantee you it has high fees. And I guarantee you that rider benefit is what they call that income benefit. The insurance industry calls it a rider benefit, has an additional fee on top of that. Your total all-in fees on that annuity are probably close to 3% or more a year. You want it to reach zero. That's what you bought the annuity for, was the income benefit, that if you lived long enough and it reached zero, they would keep paying you. You want it to reach zero because you paid for this income benefit. You want it to get to zero and you live multiple years after that so you can start getting money from the insurance company. So you want it to reach zero, but the insurance company is going to limit how much money you take out of that. And generally speaking, if you break it and take more out, they will cut your payment proportionately. So if you took 50% more out than you should, they'll cut your payments by 50%. So for life. So it's a very, very strict set of rules you have to follow. But I hope you pass away and your beneficiaries have nothing. That means you lived long enough to get your money out. And because of the high fees associated with a lot of those broker-sold annuities, again, I'm guessing 3%, Chris, that $24,000 he's entitled to, I bet you that's close to 5, 6% of his account balance, because we got to start getting into pretend account and all this, which I don't want to get into. So that 24,000, folks, is probably representing close to 5 or 6% of his account balance. You throw the 3% in fees that are still coming out of that also every year, he's looking at about an 8 or a 9% annual withdrawal from that annuity. It probably won't last as long as he does. And that's good. You want it to reach zero and start getting money from the insurance company. That's what you were paying for when you bought that annuity. So anyways, that's how a withdrawal annuity will work with RMDs. It can be used to offset other RMDs.
And there's an identifiable account balance, which makes this pretty, straightforward.
I'm glad you mentioned that. So you do live long enough, listener, in my hypothetical example here, and now you're getting into your early 80s and the account balance reaches zero, Chris. And they were still paying him the $24,000. Now what happens?
Now they treat it as if it was annuitized, because there is no longer an account balance. So technically the RMD would be zero, but they're continuing to pay you that money. And you, like I said, you can't do the math anymore because you don't have an account balance and the RMD is effectively zero, but they don't let you aggregate at that point.
Nope. So once it reaches zero, the rules of annuitization apply.
Right.
And the excess RMDs, because there's no longer an account balance, you can't figure out what was the normal RMD and what is the excess. So the entire $24,000 at that point is the RMD for that annuity IRA only and cannot be used to offset the RMD from other IRAs.
Yep.
And that's going to have to wrap it up because this went long. But one little trick that I have done in the past, I've had people in situations that he just described, Chris, but they also have a 401k or had a 401k that they would take an RMDs from or required to take RMDs from. I showed them that if they were to move that 401k to another IRA after taking their RMD first, beginning the following year, let's just say this gentleman had no other IRA to offset the $16,700 in our example, or he could only offset $6,700 of it. There was still $10,000 more than he needed to take out as an RMD from his IRAs. But he had $1 million 401k over here, and he was required to take $30,000, $40,000 out of that. If he moves that 401k to an IRA, now that excess $10,000 in my example, or $16,700 in the previous example, could offset the RMD on that $1 million IRA. But if it stays in a 401k, it can't. So if you have one of these IRAs that have these withdrawal benefit annuities in them, and you don't have any excess IRAs that you could be reducing your RMDs on, but you have a 401k, move all of it or some of it over, at least to the point where the RMD of that now 401k rollover IRA more than covers the excess money you're getting from that withdrawal annuity. So you're not being forced to take more out than you need. Hopefully that makes sense, but I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say before you run out and do that, that then starts to become one component in more of an overall tax planning situation. So you'd want to look at all the ramifications of this, because essentially what you're doing there is deferring, more for later that are going to come out of that. You used an example of a 401k. Might make a good you know, might be a good strategy, might not, depending on the rest of your situation. So when you get into some of the more fancy things, make sure you look at the broad spectrum of tax ramifications in this decision, not just kind of these one-off. I think that's where a lot of people get in trouble with tax planning, is they make these little incremental independent decisions and they don't really look at the whole story and a projection looking forward. So might make sense to do what you're saying, but in certain circumstances, that might not be the, you know, best way to go.
Perfect. Anyways, folks, there's a little bit about RMDs. Hopefully you learned something you didn't know before. And well, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. And we appreciate you listening. Appreciate you sending in the email that prompted this. May not have been your intention for it to generate an EDU show. But for both the Q&A show and the EDU show, we get inspiration from our listeners. So really appreciate you still connecting with us. If you want to send in your own questions, comments, suggestions, jim@jimhelps.com is the proper email to use. Make sure in the subject line you indicate it's an email regarding the podcast, and we'll hope that we include your topic in an upcoming show, whether it's an individual question for the Q&A or maybe becomes an EDU show. So thanks a lot, Jim. You take care, and we'll be back with everybody next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.